Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And first and only time, Flashback Friday. I know the province announced more reopening plans today. We're going backwards, though. I'm back in my sweatpants, back at home. Stephen Brunt in his home studio. How's it going? Happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday. Yes, we are... it's also kind of, well, it's fallback Friday for the Leafs, right? Like they're just, you know, like the clocks are going to go back at a certain point, right? Any moment now, but the Leafs just got ahead of it. They're doing it. They're just doing it on their own.
they jumped the shark as they're about to play the San Jose Sharks tonight at the Scotiabank Arena. Yeah, 6 o'clock start, which was head scratching for us all week, and we got a little bit of. An understanding as to why yesterday, and Gord Stellick alerted us to the potential reasons why, and that's the best we got, is that the Leafs are traveling to the United States for the first time since the pandemic. After this game, they're going to Pittsburgh to play the Penguins, and they're not sure how long it's going to take to get across the border, so they figured 1 hour is going to make all the difference. I say, why not go whole hog, Stephen? Why didn't they play at noon today?
Yeah, that's right. Because it would have, then there'd be no worry, right? There'd be no worry whatsoever.
Right.
You'd have lots of, you could drive to Pittsburgh. You know, it's about a 5 hour drive, maybe. And they could have saved themselves all kinds of hassles if they'd done that. But we're not going to ever see another one of these, right?
So this is, yeah, no, there's one more
thing to say.
No, there's one more. Yes, it's the week that you've decided to leave me in the lurch. You've abandoned me for that week, and I think there is another 6 o'clock start for the Toronto Maple Leafs on a Friday. If I'm not mistaken,
are they going to a different country then? Because like otherwise this explanation doesn't make that much sense, right? Isn't this like, are they thinking that every time they go to America on a Friday it's going to be, or on a weeknight or whatever it is, that it's going to be bad? Because it's just kind of a first time thing. This is the first time.
You know what? Sleep is such a huge part of planning for professional athletes and professional sports franchises. And of course, you're the home team. You can play whenever you want. The Leafs could, if they wanted to, play at noon. I don't think it would be a wise decision, television rating wise. Already a team that can't sell out a game yet. And I haven't checked, but I imagine there's still tickets available for tonight's game. But yeah, if maybe it's just a front end of back-to-backs thing, that would make sense. If you're just trying to gain an hour of sleep, if you're playing on the front end of a back-to-back and you're traveling in between, that makes as much sense as anything I can come up with.
Yeah, I guess. Like it's about a half hour in the air to Pittsburgh. You're the son of a pilot, you know this, right? But how yes. far is it to, how long is, what's the air time to Pittsburgh?
Never flown to Pittsburgh, just driven
short, though.
Through
it's shortish.
Through Pittsburgh. I don't think you get an in-meal flight in-flight meal. I don't think you can watch an entire movie. I think you got to watch like the 20-minute Friends episode if you're on that flight.
and I believe it's in the same time zone as us, right? So there's not a terrible jet lag issue going to Pittsburgh.
No, it's a great point. I buy
Gord Stellick's explanation because it's the best one we've had so far. And I hope they're all tucked into their beds at what 11 o'clock Pittsburgh time or 11:30 or whatever it's going to be. I hope they have a bed check and make sure they're all sleeping.
Yeah, and maybe they'll sleep soundly after Michael Hutchison comes up with a spectacular performance. Every time you think you're out of the Michael Hutchison experience, he pulls you back in, Stephen. And I got to tell you, I'm not quite buying his .919 save percentage that he put up last year. And the Maple Leafs gave us some indication as to their level of trust in him when they did everything in their power to not have him appear in a single game last season by acquiring Aaron Dell. They couldn't hold on to him even for game one of the regular season, couldn't slip him through waivers, and all of a sudden it was Michael Hutchison back in our lives for 8 games last year. He played well in those 8 games. Before that, I again, not buying the .919 save. And here he is in game number 5 of the season in this bizarro regular season, a regular season in which the Toronto Maple Leafs went out and got another goaltender. He didn't even last 60 minutes of his first game, and we're back into Michael Hutchison world.
Yeah, but he beat out the guy from U of T. Don't forget that.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, it's a situation where I don't think goaltending is going to make or break this team, and I think Jack Campbell is a good goaltender. I think he proved that he can, if he's healthy, be a pretty viable number one last year. But yeah, you don't ever want to be in a situation where you're relying on Jack Campbell to start every game that's not a back-to-back, because Michael Hutchison is his backup. This is a guy who's not exactly been a picture of health. Peter Mrazek hasn't been the picture of health either, to be quite frank.
No. The Mrazek, we'll see. Again, I know everything's vague in terms of injuries and recovery times and return, but it doesn't sound like this is going to be long term. But Peter Mrazek's return to health and the Leafs' ability to spread the goaltending load around and get competent, or plus goaltending from both guys over the course of a long season. Like that, yeah, they're not going to live or die. It's not going to be about a goaltender stealing games for this team, I don't think. That's kind of not the way they're going to have to steal games by scoring more goals. But I think that idea of having two guys who can balance out the workload a bit and both, it was talked about as a goaltending upgrade, right? Everybody was kind of just got tired of Frederik Andersen, I guess, and, what he was and what he wasn't in the playoffs. I think the timing of Peter Mrazek's recovery and, how this plays out, like if we're looking back at this season and they had to run Jack Campbell into the ground, I'm guessing it won't be a very good season.
No, that's not an ideal situation. I think Jack Campbell was the kind of the presumptive starter going into this year with Peter Mrazek, but if Mrazek got hot, maybe he could have ended the season with more starts. But yeah, it was supposed to be a shared workload. When Mrazek goes down, it's not a shared workload between Michael Hutchison and Jack Campbell. Jack Campbell is a starter, and Michael Hutchison is starting on these back-to-backs. On the front half of back-to-backs, by the way, I'm old enough to remember, Stephen, when Mike Babcock just scoffed at the idea of the backup starting game one of these back-to-backs as if that was the most absurd idea anyone had ever concocted. It actually made sense at the time, and I was wondering why he was so adverse to the idea. It makes sense. Michael Hutchison is the inferior goaltender. Why not make his job easier? Not to say that the Sharks are a pushover. They're undefeated this season in three games, but they're on a Canadian road trip and maybe a little bit tired. This is supposed to be the easier game. Why not give the easier game to the guy who's maybe going to have a tougher time of it? That makes sense to me.
More sense than kind of arbitrary game one versus game two. Which was guy, it does. It makes and whatever happens tonight, I'm not. It's not the wrong choice to play him tonight. It's the right choice. And if he holds his own, maybe not even plus goaltending, but if he holds his own and the Leafs get through a few games, the necessary games with him in net, because I'm thinking he's going to play. What, 25% of the games between now and whenever Mrazek comes back?
Yeah.
You kind of hold your own in those games, and maybe you do spot him in against slightly inferior opponents or really inferior opponents. You get through this, right? That's got to be the goal right now.
Yeah, speaking of goals, Maple Leafs would be well advised to score a few. Like they really haven't done that yet. I know they had a million chances, and Shesterkin was unbelievable on Monday, and they will come, and Austin Matthews has only played one game. And I also understand that if you were going to choose one thing for these guys to look like they're capable of doing early on in the season would be limiting opposing scoring chances because they have such an incredible history of scoring goals. But, might be nice to eventually pot five. That would be at least appealing to the eye. Maybe tonight will be the night for that.
That will. Well, I'm going to make a guarantee. That will happen. That will happen very soon. That may well happen. Starting at 6 o'clock tonight, because you saw it in that Rangers game. They did run up against a guy who was kind of unconscious, and you saw Austin Matthews looking like he was fired out of a cannon. I think this team is not going to be offensively challenged. Even stretches on the power play where they had lots of possession and were kind of dazzling. So I think they're going to be. I think offensively they're going to be just fine. That's a brave prediction.
How about the Habs? Are they going to be just fine, Steven?
Ooh, Well, of course, we had the great Ren Lavoie on yesterday, setting that, you know, setting things up like only he can, right? The whole drama of Mark Bergevin and his calling a press conference to try and calm the waters and take blame and responsibility upon himself, although not seeming kind of hangdog in the process. And of course, you know, the opponent had to be Carolina, and not just Carolina, but Carolina and their crack social media department. Boy,
yeah.
Talk about spiking the ball, right? Like I want to hang with those guys. I want to hang with that crowd.
Worth
whatever
penny.
Whatever room they are locked in Carolina, have it, you know, cranking beers and laughing at each other's jokes. Like that's what it feels like, and it's awesome. It's on a plate for them. Thank you, Montreal Canadiens. And you know, thank you for setting up, you know, becoming a punchline. It's I'm not sure how they're feeling in Montreal today. Well, I think I know how they're feeling in Montreal today. You know, really angry and frustrated, and this isn't getting any better.
No, it's really not. And yeah, I mean, you couldn't have scripted a more depressing day for Montreal Canadiens fans, because not only does Kotkaniemi score after they boot him lustily, which I guess was predicted by our friend Ren. I didn't see the introductions, actually, the pregame introductions, but I'm guessing he wasn't cheered then either. Like, I'm thinking the booing started as soon as possible. But Aho scores as well. Yeah, mm-hmm. You only score one goal again. Like, it's just the offense has been just totally absent of this Montreal Canadiens start. And I understand you got some young, good scorers that still have the potential to create an offense there. But we kept doing this thing with the Blue Jays, looking at the Red Sox and their potential World Series victory and how tough a pill that might be to swallow for Jays fans. Like, for Leaf fans to watch what's happened here, and yes, the notable departures, I get it. A couple of guys are going into the Hall of Fame who are not currently playing for the Montreal Canadiens, who were massive parts of that postseason success a year ago. But this team isn't all that different. It really isn't. I got to tell you, they couldn't score for long stretches in the postseason either. It just happened that they were limiting the goals against because of Shea Weber and Carey Price. But for Leaf fans to watch what maybe, I was going to say it's predictable, not this bad, but like many people were predicting, including our pal Ren, that they would not be the juggernaut that they turned into by the end of the postseason. It's just, it's heart-wrenching for Leaf fans to watch what's happened to the Montreal Canadiens.
Well, yeah, they did finish, what, 28 points behind the Leafs in the hothouse division in the regular season. That's what they were. Then they were, I believe they were trailing in that playoff series that last I looked before the world turned on its axis. Give them, it does happen, you know, teams for a variety of reasons, normally, you know, often a hot goaltender's part of it that can go on a run in the playoffs. They don't usually get to the Stanley Cup final that way if they're lousy, but you know, that was exceptional. But the notion that they would come back to earth, yeah, it made sense they would come back to earth with no Shea Weber, and especially with the, you know, not just no Carey Price, but the kind of, you know, the kind of traumatic nature of Carey Price's departure and all of that, and you know, relying very heavily on some young players to, you know, who are going to be good and are good, but you're asking a little too much of them at this stage. And there's a bunch of reasons why they would, you know, they would not be the team that we last saw in the last Stanley Cup playoffs. But you know, for them to be sub Buffalo right now, that I'm not sure I didn't see that one coming. And I know Buffalo's actually, you know, done just fine getting off there. But that, if that's the bar, right? Like, are they, uh-huh, they are right now sub Buffalo.
Well, and the other team that you could throw in there, although they're off to a good start too, is the Detroit Red Wings, who, lo and mm-hmm. behold, go to Montreal tomorrow night. Sans Tyler Bertuzzi. And yeah, you don't want to do these overreaction things, and we're definitely not overreacting to the Raptors one game, right? And it's only five games. They play 82 of these things, but I got to tell you, Stephen, to put up a lackluster offensive showing and to lose tomorrow at home to the Detroit Red Wings, I know it's you can bounce back in theory, but boy, it almost feels like if what we've seen for the first five games continues to a sixth, and they become the first team, by the way, no one's ever done this, the first team to ever make it to a cup final and go 0-6, I would not be surprised if we hear something massive following that game involving Marc Bergevin or something. Like, it's just been there's bad starts, there's horrible narratives, and then there's this. I don't know if I've ever seen anything like this.
Yeah, but what, like, look, on a rare occasion, firing a coach in
right.
sports will turn a team, will shake a team up, or the voice changes in the room, or, you know, all of that stuff. Or they all hate the guy, and if you get rid of him, they suddenly are liberated. So, but have you ever heard of a team firing a general manager and the team getting better?
I don't know. I've never heard.
No, but doesn't happen in the middle of a season very often, yeah. right? Because, and I'm not sure how that would. And you're not gonna, you can't really go and fire the coach because, you know, you fired the last coach, and
yep.
you know this guy got you to the Stanley Cup final. Like I think Jeff Molson. I like Jeff Molson a lot, and I think he's been a pretty darn good steward of this franchise in a lot of ways, but. I think he boxed himself in, you know, well, circumstances boxed him in maybe because of the success last year, the unexpected success. But, you know, launching into this season with a GM in a lame duck situation, a guy with on a 1 year left, when there certainly was a possibility that the team that last spring was a little bit of a mirage, and, you know, it's hard to, fire him after that. But if you don't extend him, this is going to go, like, best case, this goes on all season, right? The wither Marc Bergevin debate, and that's not good. Like, that, again, I'm not sure it distracts players, but it also means your franchise is, you're not going anywhere, right? You're twisting until either Marc Bergevin is given a vote of confidence, which would be tough right now, and said, okay, you keep doing what you're doing and what you have been doing low these many years. Or you get rid of him, and then what do? You know, who's an interim? Do you bring in an interim general manager in the middle of a hockey season when general managers don't do much?
Yeah,
you know, until the trade deadline. I think, you know, I like maybe Jeff Molson anticipated, but there was nothing. Just he might have felt powerless, right? That he didn't want to extend him, but he didn't want to fire him. Well, this is where you end up in this just unbelievably awkward middle ground.
Yeah, it's. Truly, like, precedent setting. Like I said, no team has ever made it to a cup final and gone 0-6, and okay,
wow.
they got Detroit on Saturday, but Detroit's off to a good start, although they don't have their leading scorer who's decided to stay home, or forced to, because he hasn't been vaccinated, and that's Tyler Bertuzzi. Anyways, just a wild, wild scene. We should have shut up about Chris Taylor coming to the Blue Jays. We should have just
I know yeah, and his price just went up. Everybody knows about him now. Okay, I thought he was our little secret.
He's a clutch playoff performer, I would say. First player ever to have a three-homer game with his team facing elimination. I don't know, I love his swing. I love his setup and his vicious rip at the ball. But yeah, the Dodgers are not only off the mat, but yeah. I'm sure there's thoughts going through the Braves' heads about what exactly happened a year ago against this team, as it's just a 3-2 series deficit. And there's Chris Taylor, pending free agent. You know what? Maybe the situation should be reminiscent of Justin Turner, right, who was a pending free agent after last year's World Series. He had a great postseason. There were some people talking about the Blue Jays going after him to fill their third base need. And he just, the Dodgers wouldn't let him leave. Maybe they still let Chris Taylor walk, because you mentioned it, Ben Nicholson Smith with the great write-up on Sportsnet.ca about how the Dodgers have been great about not being sentimental and letting guys go when they gotta go. But holy cow, has this guy been a major part of the successes of this team in the postseason. And yesterday was the cherry on top.
You know, I was thinking about it. Like have you ever... Can you remember a time when a team going home up 3-2 in a best of seven, you know, in a baseball playoff, would have felt as shaky as the Atlanta Braves do right now? Right,
yeah.
They got to win one or two at home, and you know, but that means they've got to beat one of, and Lord knows you can't take starting pitching for granted in these playoffs, but it means you've got to beat one of Max Scherzer or Walker Buehler, and you have to beat the team that did exactly this to you last year. Like, I'm not saying they had to win that game last night, but maybe they had to win that game last night, right? Maybe that's, you know, the bullpen game, Joe Kelly out early, Max Fried's pretty darn good, you're feeling it, you've got the Dodgers on the ropes, and instead they get run over by Taylor and company, and everybody else in that bullpen game for the Dodgers pitches pretty well. And now, like, I just you know what kind of a guy Max Scherzer is, right? Like, the adrenaline's cranking right now, right? Like, he's going to go out there, you know, for however sore and dead-armed he was the last time, he's going to try and put on a show. And, you know, and then it, you know, potentially pushes it to Game 7. Like, it's just, normally, if you would win one or two coming home against the defending world champions, you'd be pretty darn happy. I think they're pretty darn nervous probably in Atlanta right now.
Oh, for sure. And you know what? I guess we could have seen it coming. I don't know if we would have predicted it, but you know what kind of stood out to me? And Twitter was alerting me to the fact that there was only like 80% capacity at Dodger Stadium yesterday. You want to talk about fickle fans? Your team won 106 games during the regular season. The defending World Series champs. And yeah, they're down 3-1. The exact spot, like, you just have to go back 12 months to the exact same spot, and they came back to win and eventually win a World Series. Come on, if there was a time to believe your team could get off the mat, it would be this team in this circumstance. But no, I saw lots of empty seats yesterday at Dodger Stadium. I guess it's the way of the world. You can't sell anything out anymore.
Well, I was going to say, how could it be? You can't be blasé, right? Until last year, they hadn't won a World Series since 1988. I know they're in the playoffs all the time. And last year, they won a World Series. Did they not win it in Arlington, Texas?
Yeah, like,
wasn't that in a bubble? Like, well, yeah. I'm trying to forget all that stuff, but I think they were in a bubble. That's a very odd one in a place where, you know, the Dodgers routinely outdraw, you know, in normal times, everybody else in baseball, even when they're not winning a World Series. Yeah, that's, they can't be jaded. Can they?
Boy, I would hope not. But yeah, I don't know. It's just really bizarre. Kind of reminded me of that Blue Jays, the postseason game against the Royals at Rogers Center after R.A. Dickey got blasted, and they came back and won and sent it back to Kansas City. But it was an afternoon game, but there were tickets to be had there too. It is amazing how quickly fans get a little bit jaded. You mentioned Texas and the American League Championship Series shifting back there tonight. And, you know, the Red Sox do have the starting pitching advantage, I guess, on paper. Mm-hmm. Luis Garcia has been brutal in his one start against the Red Sox in this series, where he went an inning, gave up 5 earned runs and walked 3, and the Red Sox have Nathan Eovaldi. But, you know, for all the incredible offensive numbers that the Red Sox have put up, Stephen, I was shocked at this, because I just saw it mentioned, and I was like, I'll check the numbers, that the Red Sox were a much better offensive team at home at Fenway Park this season than they were on the road. Like, it is shockingly so. They were the top team in OPS at home this season. Blue Jays were second. They're the 14th in baseball on the road. Blue Jays still second. So you want to talk about a team that might be a Fenway Park creation, and even by the end of those games at Fenway Park in this series, they weren't swinging the bats. But that's a pretty good indication that perhaps the fraud that we thought the Red Sox might be showing up here in this game, and they might be headed home.
Yeah, that Jays home number would include those other homes, right?
Correct.
A single A ballpark and the launch pad that is Salem Field, right? So that, that is a striking differential with the Red Sox. Garcia was terrible in his last start. He was terrible against the White Sox too, and he's been kind of in and out terrible for the last month or month and a half. So he is no sure thing. You know, like, you could say he's due, but, you know, he's had two just dreadful postseason starts. So it kind of goes back to what we've been saying about Houston. You know, with their pitching issues again. It looks like McCullers, by the way, is not going to. No World Series for Lance McCullers, it sure looks like. He hasn't even thrown a ball yet.
That's
so
brutal.
If they get to the World Series, I'm not sure who's going to be pitching for them. But if they get even middling pitching, they're going to win. They're going to beat just about everybody. But there is no guarantee that they will get even middling pitching tonight.
Nope.
Again, they may be deep into that bullpen really early once again. So we'll see, right? They obviously have a huge advantage in this series right now. I expect them to win this series. I expect them to win this series going in. But I'd kind of you know, I kind of bet on Max Scherzer going seven strong in that start for the, you know, for the Dodgers. I wouldn't bet on Luis Garcia going 2 1/3 strong.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that would be about what he's well, he didn't go an inning strong, but he only lasted an inning in his last start in this series. So yeah, not all that hot a take, considering the kind of starting pitching the Astros have had really all postseason, but especially in this American League Championship Series. All right, let's take a break. Let's come back with our friend Jeff Merrick of The Jeff Merrick Show and the 32 Thoughts podcast as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Time Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Leafs and San Jose Sharks from Scotiabank Arena tonight at 6 o'clock. For some reason, perhaps it's more convenient for our next guest. I don't know. He's a power broker. Maybe this is at his request. I'm not sure. Jeff Merrick of The Jeff Merrick Show.
Yeah.
12-2. What's going on?
I don't think I have that much stroke, Ben, but I appreciate you trying to put that out there for me. No, this is an early one that the Maple Leafs get out on the road.
Yeah, I like it. Listen, it's convenient for me. So yeah, if they asked me, I would have said, you know what, start it at 5. But yeah, six will have to do. But yeah,
6-5. What's the deal?
6 it is. Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about this is it's the San Jose Sharks, and the one thing about San Jose is on the eastern side of things, they always do a 10:30 Eastern start, which
yes.
teams always complain about. I think this is deliberate. If you're listening, Doug Wilson, I'm aiming this one at you, GM of the San Jose Sharks. I think they do it deliberately to inconvenience teams who don't get to lounge around after the game. They got to shower up and dress and hustle to catch a flight so they don't get stranded. They don't do the 10 o'clock starts. It's always a 10:30 Eastern start out in San Jose.
Maybe this is what's good for the goose, good for the gander. This is a 3 o'clock Pacific time start, so in your face.
Take
Sharks.
That, fan base. Yeah, enjoy that one.
Maybe. I don't know. So Canadian teams are 7-9-3 against the American teams early on. Are we going to make retroactive? I'm asking you.
The North Division is done. Are we already nostalgic about the Scotia North Division? Is
no,
that what this is? Like,
no,
I understand
not.
That we live in a world right now where the time between when an event happens and we start to feel nostalgic about it is about a cozy 5 minutes. But are we really doing the Canada versus U.S. thing still?
Well, I'm asking you if you're having any retroactive thoughts about the quality of that division. Can you? I mean, there's obviously a lot of differences in the rosters
changed.
Of these two teams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, teams have changed. I mean, but the one thing that stands out early so far is we thought the Metro was going to be a really tough division, but holy smokes. Have you seen the Metropolitan Division? 1, 2, 3, only 5 losses in the division. Like, there's going to be a really good team. Right now, in the Islanders, who many have predicted to not just win the division, but win the Stanley Cup, they've only won one game, right? They're 1-2-1. Now, they're starting the season off with a 13-game road trip until the new building is ready, but still, like, that is a real, I would more so go division by division than Canada versus U.S. That Metro looks like a killer so far early on. And no
Crosby and Malkin yet.
And no Crosby and Malkin yet. And don't look now, but Columbus is right in there too. Like, the Columbus Blue Jackets, like, I don't think that they're going to do much this season, but I know that they're not going to be an easy out. I don't think there are any easy outs in the Metro this year.
Jeff, we've been kind of wallowing in this Montreal story, but I've got to ask you about it. We had the great Ren Lavoie on yesterday, who does make the Habs stuff sound like, you know, the plot of an opera, which it is, right? And that's why he's awesome. But what, you know, put yourself in Jeff Molson's shoes at the end of last season with Marc Bergevin coming up on the last year of his contract and having your team unexpectedly and gloriously go to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah.
What would you have done?
If I was Jeff Molson in the offseason?
Yeah.
Or if I was Marc Bergevin in the offseason?
Well, let's start with Jeff Molson, because he had the option of extending for, you know, or of...
I think he wants to extend him, though. I think he wants to extend Mark Bergevin. It seems as if, and rightly or wrongly, people have pointed at the Chris Drury contract in New York, which we believe is somewhere in the fours, as sort of resetting the marketplace for general managers. I would point out, though, that Chris Drury just doesn't have the general manager position. He also has team president. So it's a dual role he's fulfilling now. But I think the point is made that the Chris Drury contract has sort of reset it for a lot of general managers. Now, I don't know if the issue for Bergevin is the decimal point or it's just sheer exhaustion. I mean, that job wears on you. Remember, Brian Burke would always tell me, you know, Montreal is the toughest place to play. And I would say, well, why is that? And or the toughest place to manage. And he would say, well, when you make a mistake and people say you're dumb, they say you're dumb in two languages. So you're an idiot in two languages, English and French. I mean, we always talk about what the position of U.S. president does to you know, the Obamas of the world and how different they look when they enter office and when they exit. I think the same is true of general managers in Montreal. Like, have a look at Marc Bergevin when he took over in... Geez, what was it, Stephen? 2012, 2011? Yeah. To look at him now.
Sounds right.
Now,
yeah.
He's jacked. Like he's much larger physically, and his hair is longer, but he just looks weathered now. And that job takes a pound of flesh every season. I mean, if I'm Jeff Molson, because it almost has seemed every step of the way the visions have been aligned. You look to extend, but I'm not 100% sure that Marc Bergevin wants to extend. I mean, you look at that press conference this week, and he said, "Yes, in a perfect world, you know, I stay a member of the Montreal Canadiens. I extend, and I'm still the general manager here." That's a pretty big caveat in a perfect world. That's not just coming out and saying, "Yeah, I want to be the general manager." If everything aligns here. It's almost as if, you know, Bergevin at that press conference kind of kicked things upstairs and said, "Hey, I want to be here. Talk to the big guy. I've done everything that I can here. I took the team to the Stanley Cup final." I would have extended if I was Jeff Molson, provided that the visions were still aligned. But if you look at what Montreal did, you know, last offseason, they went out and the plan was very deliberate. It was, let's get Stanley Cup winners in here. It was Jake Allen. It was Joel Edmondson. It was Corey Perry. It was Eric Staal. Like, that was the MO. We're bringing in, you know, we're bringing in Stanley Cup players that have been there before. This offseason, it was all French-Canadian hockey players. Like, it was Paquette. It was Savard. It was Montembeau. Like, there was a very deliberate move by the general manager to bring in as many Quebecois players as possible. Whereas last year, they went out and tried to get that. Yes.
Why?
I don't know. I wonder if it was, you know, there's always an element of the fan base that wants as many Quebecois players as possible. And there's an element of the media that wants as many Quebecois players as possible. And that's always existed. You know, we see it played out when they hire a new coach, and it has to be a bilingual coach. It has to be a bilingual general manager. Many have said that limits their choices, narrows the field. Others have said, you know, the Montreal Canadiens are as much part of the culture of Quebec as they are just a sports team, and we want someone that reflects that. I see both sides of it.
I don't know. I don't see it with players. Sorry, that's I get it with communication part of, like, I understand. I've seen a lot of coaches, you know, deal with that in Montreal, deal with the double-headed media. It's super challenging. I remember when Pat Burns was there, and they used to mock the way he spoke French, even though he was a cop there, right? Yeah. It's brutal, but I think it's necessary because you do have to speak to both sides of the great divide there. And same for the general manager, but for players, my God, like I'd almost go the other way because of what happens to any Quebecois player, right? They're either, you know, like you can be, you know, up on a pedestal. Really, really fast, Stéphane Lebeau or something, right? And suddenly you're a folk hero for about a week, and then it comes crashing down. Like, I think it's a brutal place for a Quebecois player to be.
It's tough. Yeah, Mathieu Perreault, there's another one they brought in the off season. I think we can, like, do you remember when the All-Star game was in Montreal and Vincent Lecavalier was playing for the Tampa Bay Lightning? And there was, you know, strong speculation. And Brian Lawton, who was then the general manager, has talked about this openly. So I'm not sort of telling tales out of school here, breaking news. But, I mean, there were I don't want to say there was a deal in place, but they were getting pretty warm to having a deal in place for Vinny LeCavalier to become a Montreal Canadian. And Stephen, I will always remember the visual of Vincent LeCavalier's eyes at the Montreal airport. This is All-Star Weekend. LeCavalier is going, and he gets off the plane, and it is fans and media and flashbulbs, and it was like Beatles Come to America. Right? It was crazy. And I just remember the look on LeCavalier's face saying, I don't have trade protection until July. Am I really in store for this? Like, there have been players that have been... I remember, you know, Daniel Briere didn't... I mean, he eventually ended up, you know, playing for the Montreal Canadiens. But when he was, you know, at the height of his power, he didn't want to go and play in Montreal. You know what it can do to a player. Sure, the highs are high, but man, the lows are awful. Ask any player that's been through it in Montreal. And for French Canadian hockey players, you're bang on. Ask any of the guys. Ask David Desharnais what it was like. When you're hot and you're scoring, that's great. But when your stick gets cold, it gets vicious, and it gets vicious in a hurry. So I know if I'm a French Canadian hockey player, as much as, you know, my heartstrings may be tugged to come and, you know, play for the Bleu Blanc et Rouge, that's what your heart is saying. Your head's probably telling you something different.
Yeah, it's not for everybody. You know, playing for any Canadian franchise, not for everybody. But yeah, the reward of winning a Stanley Cup is if you get there, worth what you have to go through. I wonder what you think. Like, if this is Marc Bergevin's final season in Montreal, and I guess we don't know how this season will play out. Although the first five games, pretty good indication, not well. How will you view his tenure there in Montreal and what he's done? They had a couple of pretty deep playoff runs. Obviously, the last one getting all the way to a Cup final. But how will you view it?
To be honest with you, not great. And I know they made it to the Stanley Cup final, albeit in a shortened season. In a season where there was a lot of talk that he was going to lose his job and the coach was going to get fired as well. Like, he's the one thing I'll say about Bergevin is he endured. He's endured a lot. He's gone through a couple of different rebuilds with this Montreal team. There have been some squandered opportunities with high draft picks, most notably Alexander Galchenyuk. And we can talk about his development, Jesperi Kotkaniemi, and the offer sheet. Those were a couple of third overall draft picks that didn't pan out for the Montreal Canadiens. But you know, it's a team that didn't. See, whenever I say they didn't draft well, part of me always says, "Well, hold on, drafting is just one part, and then developing is another." It's a team that had a hard time bringing young players into the system and then creating an environment where they would be successful when they graduated to the big team. He was always someone that liked to go free agent shopping. He was someone that wasn't shy about making the big trade, making the big move. Like, the one thing that I will say about Bergevin is he's bold. I mean, the PK Subban-Shea Weber deal is a humongous deal. Like, that was a whopper. He swung for the fences. He wasn't shy about sticking his neck out. And the one thing that I will, again, if this ends up being the last season for Bergevin, the one thing that I'll say about him is, you know, he heard the criticism, but I don't know that he ever let it affect him. Like, we've seen managers in Montreal affected by the fans and affected by the media. You know, I can recall a day, and Stephen will remember this story as well, you know, when Red Fisher essentially, in a lot of ways, ran the Montreal Canadiens.
Yes, at least he thought he did, Jeff.
Well, I mean, but there's a couple examples where he did, too, right? There was a Lemieux-Corson for Clark Lehman trade that was, you know, pretty close to being put to bed. Red Fisher caught wind of it, you know, called up Montreal management and said, if you make this deal, I'll run you all out of town. And then the deal went away. And all of a sudden, that deal between the Habs and the Maple Leafs never happened. Like, that's how much power Red had over that organization. But Bergevin never wavered. Like, I never found a moment, I don't know if you guys ever did, where you looked at it and you said, he's just making that move under pressure. He's making that move to appease a fan base or to appease his owner or just to save his job. I never got that sense from Marc Bergevin.
Yeah. You only have the power to change the start time of games, not, you know, impact trades. Maybe that's the next level for you. I don't know. We'll see.
I have none.
Yeah, right. Before that you go, I want to get your sense of this Michael Bunting thing, because I'm growing more and more convinced. 10 goals in 21 games for the Coyotes last year. He's got 2-4 this year. So I guess, like, we're looking at 40 goals over the course of an 82-game season for Michael Bunting. I'm starting to believe, Jeff.
Okay, so hang on a second here. Hold on. So we just talked about Montreal. We just talked about Quebecois players and the stress of playing for the Montreal Canadiens.
He's not feeling it. The Scarborough kid, he's not feeling it.
When things go bad at home in Canada, ask Sheldon Surrie what it's like going back home to Edmonton or Sherwood Park, how badly that can work out. Listen, I like Michael Bunting. I've liked him going back to when he played junior hockey. I love what he did with the Coyotes last year. Love the energy that he brings. And, like, he's a guy that both the old school and the new school fans in this city will like. Like the old school guys that just want the return of Dougie and Wendell, they'll love a guy like Michael Bunting. And new school fans will like him as well. Like he is, you know, he's the annoying guy to play against that you love having on your team. I like him. I don't know what the production is going to come anywhere close to sustaining. But Maple Leafs fans have always loved this type of player. But then again, doesn't every fan base love a player like this? Like I always sort of sideways laugh when I say, like, oh, man, you know, Toronto loves a player like that. Well, what market doesn't? He's a blue-collar guy, a lunch pail guy, goes to work, works hard. You know, he's like has, you know, blood on his jersey every game. You know, he earns it in sweat. What's the old saying? Sweat saves blood. It's the old World War I saying, and that's true of guys like Michael Bunting. Like every market loves a guy like that, and I don't expect Toronto to be any different.
Oh yeah, he has all the ingredients. He's the local kid. He took less money to be here, and he goes to the net. I mean, come on! Like he couldn't have added.
And he gets bruised, and you know there's going to be a day where he comes up from a scrum with blood all over his face, and it's going to be splashed all over social media, and the legend will grow.
Well, yeah, he's done all right through four.
I do
games.
Like him though. I do like. I get sucked into all that too. Like I'm no different than anyone else. I love players like that. I think we all do.
No doubt. Jeff, thanks for this, pal.
It's always a good day when I get to reference Red Fisher. So thank you, gentlemen, for letting me do
we
that.
We should do a whole Red Fisher. Let's do a Red Fisher episode one of these days, okay?
I'm in.
I've got stories.
I would love, you know, I'd love to just hear them. Like I'll participate this much, Stephen. Stephen, tell us another Red Fisher story.
We should. You know, that's one where you need.
Correct me if I'm wrong. There was only because he would never talk to rookies. That was his one thing. To rookies. Was Patrick Roy the only one?
Did he talk to Patrick Roy as a rookie?
He did. I think Roy might have been the only one that he spoke to.
You know, it wasn't just players. Like when I first went there, when I was working for the Globe, went to Montreal to cover hockey. He didn't speak to me forever. Like for at least, well, I guess it was a year. And then one day. Mysteriously, I walked into the media dressing room at the Forum, and he said, "Hey, Steve, how you doing?" It was
just, you arrived.
Because that's true.
It was like the first time Jean Beliveau, when I was in ringside for Hockey Night. You know, there's that area behind the dressing room where you're standing there to do your stand up, and Mr. and Mrs. Beliveau would always walk out after the intermission. The first time that I was standing there waiting to do an interview with like Andre Markov or something like that, and he walks by and he just says, "Hello, Jeff." And I'm like, holy, like my whole world. Like, I'm just going to put this microphone down now because that's the best thing that could ever happen to me. You know, the great Jean Beliveau was saying my name to me. It was like, that's it. That's the height for my career.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for you to acknowledge me in the hallways of the radio station, Jeff. One day I'll get there. Come on,
Frank. You know that's coming.
See you, Jeffrey.
See you, Ben.
There's Jeff Merrick. Toronto FC hosting the rival CF Montreal in the 401 Derby Saturday at BMO Field. We want to send you, please keep in mind, each fan age 12 and older must present proof of full COVID-19 vaccination along with government-issued ID at entry gates to BMO Field. If you want to go, taking caller number 5 right now, 1-888-666-0590, 416-870-0590, *590 to win a pair of tickets. If you're not the lucky winner but still want to join the action on Saturday, you can purchase tickets to Saturday's match at torontofc.ca/tickets. Steven, you just made yourself more work. Way to go. Now you have to do a red shirt podcast.
I was just thinking, who do we... So we would need, you know, you would need like Pat Hickey and Michael Farber and Blair, all the Montreal Gazette crowd, Herb Zerkowski, and Bob Cole, my good friend Bob Cole, who roomed with Red Fisher for the 72 series. The summit series. He roomed with him in Moscow and elsewhere because they stopped in Prague and he had some Red Fisher stories too. So yeah, Red was, but you know, Jeff's right. Like Red, they didn't do stuff without consulting Red. Like, I mean, the team didn't do stuff without consulting Red.
Different time, a little bit. Oh, I mean, you want to talk about the power of media now? Not quite that, I would say.
Yeah, like guys like, you know, Jeff Merrick and Elliot and these guys, they you know, the insider, like, they have power, but you think they get a call from the Leafs front office saying, hey, we're thinking about doing this. But in Montreal, they did that with Red.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. We should mention also Raptors in action tonight in Boston to play the Celtics, and you know, talk about changing early season narratives, and the Celtics are off to a rough start. They lost in double overtime to the Knicks, but if you can bounce back and beat one of your rivals, you could change the narrative. Also, Mark Stein, a great NBA reporter today on his Substack, was talking about, and there's no sources cited here. He's just kind of doing his own speculation about how the Sixers could move forward in their pursuit to dismiss Ben Simmons, which Daryl Morey said could take 4 years. If they wanted to take less than 4 years, maybe re-engaging with the Raptors because they have the roster players to make it work. And he mentioned by name OG Anunoby, and he added the proper caveats, which is that Masai Ujiri loves OG Anunoby. And I don't know, Stephen, the way this Simmons thing has been handled, and then today we'll see what the fallout is with him meeting with doctors to maybe talk about his mental health. It feels like the price has not only dropped precipitously, but like I don't know what franchise worth its salt could in good conscience just trade anybody of value for this guy at the moment. You got to wait to see how this plays out almost.
Yeah. Oh God. Yes. But Mark Stein's. So his suggestion was, you know, that the Philly may realize at a certain point that they're not going to trade him for Damian Lillard, right? But
yeah,
they're
yeah.
not going to get. They're not going to. So if we're not going to do that, and then you start looking around saying, who's going to take this guy off our hands for something? And his suggestion was not. You know, again, and he's certainly not suggesting that Masai just fell off a turnip truck or something. But he said, you know, there's a place. Maybe that works. Maybe that makes sense. It would be a bold move, would it not?
Oh, absolutely. And for a team, wow. Well, for a team that we thought would struggle scoring, if game one is any indication, going to continue to struggle scoring, especially in the half court, to bring in another guy who's, you know, not dissimilar to some of the wing defenders they have already and a good ball handler, but can't shoot. Like, yeah, we talked to Grange yesterday about how many of these Raptors players just flat out can't really shoot, to get another one of those guys. I get it. He's like an all-NBA level defender. You think Pascal Siakam's a good defender? OG Anunoby is a good defender? Like, Ben Simmons might be one of the best defenders in all of the NBA, but there's two sides of the ball. And I would say also that in 2021 in the NBA, scoring, perhaps, not unlike what the NFL has become, a little more important than the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, I think so. Plus, you want to cast your lot there right now in general, even if you like the skill set and you like the physical ability? Do you really want to go there right at this moment? I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But yeah, there has been a lot of smoke surrounding the Raptors and Ben Simmons, so they've definitely engaged to some degree during the offseason. This one feels like probably not going to happen, though, because OG is definitely a part of the future for this Raptors team. We'll see, though. Raptors in Boston tonight. Toronto Maple Leafs at home against the San Jose Sharks in a game you can hear right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We'll be back in studio on Monday. This has been the Fan Drive Time. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.